Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. On today's episode, we will be discussing Book 3, Chapter 1. Then we'll be reading Book 3, Chapter 2. Already off to a good start, me stumbling over my words. Part of the course, really, isn't it? Alright, the questions I asked you guys about Chapter 1 were these. In War and Peace, 1805-ish, we had serfdom, and now in Dosto, the serfs have been emancipated. Anyone care to conduct a little Russian history lesson for context? Well, I think really the answer I wanted to know was, when did it happen? 1861 is when they were emancipated, 4 years before America followed suit by emancipating their slaves. So Russia beat you to it, America. What are you doing? Now, let me just flick back to the start of this book. What year is this set? Oh, no, it doesn't say. I thought in Chapter 1 it told us what year it was set. 1860s. Is it? I don't know. Okay, I'm not going to waste time trying to find it out. Maybe I'll just Google it. That's what I'll do. Now I've lost my page. Oh no, this is a disaster. Alright. The Brothers Karamazov. Not the Brothers Grimm. It is set in the tumultuous years following the abolition of serfdom in 1861. To be precise, the novel. If the novel is set 13 years before its publication, as the narrator tells us, this places the time of the novel around 1866. Okay, so it's only 5 years after serfdom was ended. Very interesting. 1866. Now, one other thing I wanted to read from this little article that was linked by Swim Said the Mama Fishy, responded with an article about the emancipation of the Russian serfs. Why was it necessary to end serfdom? In a number of respects, serfdom was not dissimilar to the feudalism that had operated in many parts of pre-modern Europe. However, long before the 19th century, the feudal system had been abandoned in Western Europe as it moved into the commercial and industrial age. Imperial Russia underwent no such transition. It remained economically and socially backward. Nearly all Russians acknowledged this. Some, known as Slavophiles, rejoiced, claiming that Holy Russia was a unique, God-inspired nation that had nothing to learn from the corrupt nations of the West. But to many Russians, of all ranks and classes, had come to accept that reform of some kind was unavoidable if their nation was to progress. Okay. Interesting stuff. And I say interesting, but what I mean is, yeah, semi-interesting. I was interested to learn the sort of difference between the slavery in America and the serfs in Russia. The serfs are tied to the landlord, the landowner. And essentially they were just people that lived on that land before that lord inherited that land. And by law now have to work for him. But yeah, it doesn't seem as much of like a brutal thing as the slavery in America, where it was the slaves were almost a disposable asset. They were still treated as like normal peasants, I suppose. If that's much better. I suppose it is probably quite a lot better than being an actual slave. So it does seem like, you know, even though it was a sort of form of slavery, it's not anywhere near as severe as what was happening over in America. Would I be right in saying that? I am a little bit above my, out of my depth here saying this, because I'm not that well read regarding it, but that's just kind of what I've gathered from the little bits I've seen. What's the other questions that I asked you guys? Yes. Grigory shoots down his wife's idea to move to Moscow to start a small shop in favor of staying on with Fyodor. Discuss. And Grigory's treatment of his dragon of a son was terribly sad. What were your thoughts on the matter? I Am Norwegian said, I felt bad for the wife. Honour and loyalty are laudable traits, but assigning them stupidly is a shortcut to a wasted life, which is especially sad with Marfa also being stuck supporting Fyodor. I'm still not certain who Grigory is. At times it seems like there's a friendship between Fyodor and Grigory. At other times it seems like Grigory enjoys the power he has over Fyodor, despite being a servant. He's described as good and honest, as sympathetic to Sofia, and yet little of that shows in his relationship with his wife. Marfa thinks her husband is spiritually superior, but is he really? The confusion of nature did build up some sympathy for Grigory. The way he acted, first trying to keep his distance and then grieving deeply, seemed like a very human response regarding his son. What was the timeline here? How old is the newborn baby found in Lizaveta's arms now? I wonder if we've really been introduced. I'm really interested to read about Lizaveta and her baby in this next chapter that's coming up. Kind of excited to move ahead. Techrific said, we get a flashback chapter here in order to receive a bit of a backstory on Fyodor's household. Fyodor lives isolated and alone in his oversized mansion, while his servants live in an outhouse. An outhouse has the connotation of an outdoors lavatory to me, but it seems to be more like a barn conversion, which houses not only the servants, but also the kids, Alyosha and Ivan, at different times. Here is also the kitchen, always the centre of any house, so it's a disequilibrium of an estate. The descriptions in the beginning was like a metaphor for the Karamazovs. Outside is pleasing, but dilapidated, and continues with odd little rooms and glory holes and unexpected staircases. Now, if that's not a metaphor, I don't know what is. Besides Grigory and his wife, I noticed the same Smerdiakov, a name that came up before, when Dmitri apologized for being late to the monastery because of Fyodor's servant, Smerdiakov. One more name to keep track of. Grigory is a complex character. He's described as very religious and loyal, but also as someone who was power-tripping a bit on his influence over the household and over Fyodor. He would much rather stay and have his little power and influence rather than risk the dangers of Moscow with his wife. I have sympathy for the wife. Her life must be so hard. Grigory has redeeming features as well. We've already learned in an earlier chapter that he paid for the grave of Ivan Alyosha's mother, Sofia's grave. A very decent thing to do, even though it might be tinged just a smidge with vanity and power tripping. He's doing what Fyodor is unable to do, which of course makes him, Grigory, more virtuous and a better man. Grigory is an enabler of Fyodor's weak-willed and sensualist fantasies. Grigory stays, and the debauchery can continue. As for his treatment of his son, it's an example of an unsophisticated religious view on the non-normal. Six fingers must be from the devil. God couldn't allow this, so he rejects his son. I suspect him taking in Smerdiakov is some sort of atonement and has religious meaning for him. We also get further insight into Alyosha's non-judgmental character. He is the epitome of hate the sin, love the sinner dictum. Alyosha's approach has raised what can only be described as affection in his father's heart. I wonder how the other brothers feel about that. Hate the sin, love the sinner. What a dictum that is. Man, I could stand with a little bit of that, to be honest. There's some people who are very close to me who have done things that I can't reconcile with the person that I think they are, with the actions that they've done. And it breaks my brain to think about it, and I think I indulge in an unhealthy amount of cognitive dissonance whenever I do try to indulge in thinking about that disconnect between some people's actions and some people's person. You know, I was going to say their words, but it's like the person they embody doesn't seem You know, the person that I know them as doesn't marry with the person, with the actions that I know they've committed. And that little dictum there, hate the sin, love the sinner. Just reading that made a little bit of my confusion around that melt away. Just a little bit. Yeah, that's a nice thought. Anyway, thanks for the little epiphany there, Techrific. Very much appreciated. I've already read I Am Norwegian's comment. Who's next? Swim said the Mama Fish. He said, I enjoyed the Marfa storyline. She was a serf with the Musovs, interesting connection with our Musov, taught to dance with a Moscow dancing master. She obviously lived a more sophisticated life than Grigory prior to marriage. No wonder she wanted to leave the provincial life and open a shop. Since this is 19th century Russia, Marfa subduing to her husband is treated by Dostoevsky as not remarkable. Lucky her, Grigory only pushed her around and pulled her hair. In the 21st century, Marfa would have left Grigory, opened her own shop and made millions. Summerstars says, her storyline reminded me of a book I read back in the day in college, Emily Zola's L'Assommoir. Enterprising woman, opens a laundry shop, is good at running her business and makes a profit, but is brought down by the man in her life. I wonder if Marfa would have suffered a similar fate. I Am Norwegian said, I felt like it was written in a way to make you sympathize with the wife. Her contrast with Grigory is deliberate. Consider the description very early in the book of the new type of women typical of the era, independent and motivated to prove themselves on their own, plus being timid and meek. I'm not so sure her situation would be much different today. Yeah, it was one of those, you know, that whole situation didn't reflect well on Grigory. I think he got a bit jealous with the whole dancing thing, put a quick stop to that, you know. We will not have you dancing. If I'm not a very good dancer, then you're not going to be dancing, sort of thing. And it was quite apparent that he was sort of jealously becoming a bit, what's the word, overprotective of his wife, I think. And I think that might be the same sentiment behind the not moving to Moscow to start a shop. He doesn't want her outgrowing him, I think. He's a simple man. He doesn't want her to be living the sophisticated life that he doesn't feel up to. Things like dancing and shop owning. So he roughed her up a bit. Does not reflect well on him. But there's a seed of good in the man. I think it goes back to the whole tombstone thing. Although maybe he had an affair with that woman and that's why he made the tombstone for her. That's one thing I wonder. He has his redeeming qualities, but I wouldn't say he's a good man, this guy. This Grigory. Still, keen to learn more about him. He's a good character, that's what he is. Might not be a good man, but he's a good character. Alright, all that being said, let us now do the other thing that we do, and let's read book 3, we're up to chapter 2, which is called Lizaveta. There was one circumstance which struck Grigory particularly and confirmed a very unpleasant and revolting suspicion. This Lizaveta was a dwarvish creature, not 5 foot within a wee bit, as many of the pious old women said pathetically about her after her death. Her broad, healthy red face had a look of blank idiocy, and the fixed stare in her eyes was unpleasant in spite of their meek expression. She wandered about, summer and winter alike, barefooted, wearing nothing but a hempen smock. Her coarse, almost black hair curled like lamb's wool and formed a sort of huge cap on her head. It was always crusted with mud and had leaves, bits of stick and shavings clinging to it. As she always slept on the ground and in the dirt, her father, a homeless, sickly drunkard called Ilya, had lost everything and lived many years as a workman with some well-to-do tradespeople. Her mother had long been dead. Spiteful and diseased, Ilya used to beat Lizaveta inhumanely whenever she returned to him, but she rarely did so, for everyone in the town was ready to look after her as being an idiot, and so especially dear to God. Ilya's employers, and many others in the town, especially of the tradespeople, tried to clothe her better, and always rigged her out with high boots and sheepskin coat for the winter, but although she allowed them to dress her up without resisting, she usually went away, preferably to the cathedral porch, and taking off all that had been given her, kerchief, sheepskin, skirt, or boots, she left them there and walked away barefoot in her smock as before. It happened, no one occasion, that a new governor of the province, making a tour of inspection in our town, saw Lizaveta and was wounded in his tenderest susceptibilities. And though he was told she was an idiot, he pronounced that for a young woman of 20 to wander about in nothing but a smock was a breach of the proprieties and must not occur again. But the governor went his way, and Lizaveta was left as she was at last her father died, which made her even more acceptable in the eyes of the religious persons of the town, and as an orphan. In fact, everyone seemed to like her. Even the boys did not tease her, and the boys of our town, especially the schoolboys, are a mischievous set. She would walk into strange houses, and no one drove her away. Everyone was kind to her and gave her something. If she were given a copper, she would take it and at once drop it in the alms jug of the church or prison. If she were given a roll or bun in the market, she would hand it to the first child she met. Sometimes she would stop one of the richest ladies in the town and give it to her, and the lady would be pleased to take it. She herself never tasted anything but black bread and water. If she went into an expensive shop, where there were costly goods or money lying about, no one kept watch over her, for they knew that if she saw thousands of roubles overlooked by them, she would not have touched a farthing. She scarcely even went to church. She slept either in the church porch or climbed over a hurdle, there are many hurdles instead of fences to this day in our town, into a kitchen garden. She used at least once a week to turn up at home, that is, at the house of her father's former employers, and in the winter went there every night and slept either in the passage or the cow house. People were amazed that she could stand such a life, but she was accustomed to it, and although she was so tiny, she was of a robust constitution. Some of the townspeople declared that she did all this only from pride, but that is hardly credible. She could hardly speak, and only from time to time uttered an inarticulate grunt. How could she have been proud? It happened one clear, warm, moonlit night in September, many years ago, 5 or 6 drunken revellers were returning from the club at a very late hour, according to our provincial notions. They passed through the back way, which led between the back gardens of the houses, with hurdles on either side. This way leads out onto the bridge, over the long, stinking pool, which we were accustomed to call a river. Among the nettles and burdocks under the hurdle, our revellers saw Lizaveta asleep. They stopped to look at her, laughing, and began jesting with unbridled licentiousness. It occurred to one young gentleman to make the whimsical inquiry whether anyone could possibly look upon such an animal as a woman, and so forth. They all pronounced with lofty repugnance that it was impossible, but Fyodor Pavlovitch, who was among them, sprang forward and declared that it was by no means impossible, and that, indeed, there was a certain piquancy about it, and so on. It is true that at that time he was overdoing his part as a buffoon. He liked to put himself forward and entertain the company, ostensibly on equal terms, of course, though in reality he was on a servile footing with them. It was just at that time when he had received the news of his first wife's death in Petersburg, and, with crape upon his hat, was drinking and behaving so shamelessly that even the most reckless among us were shocked at the sight of him. The revellers, of course, laughed at this unexpected opinion, and one of them even began challenging him to act upon it. Two others repelled the idea even more emphatically. Although still with the utmost hilarity, and at last they went on their way. Later on, Fyodor Pavlovitch swore that he had gone with them, and perhaps it was so. No one knows for certain, and no one ever knew. But 5 or 6 months later, all the town was talking with intense and sincere indignation of Lizaveta's condition and trying to find out who was the miscreant who had wronged her. Then suddenly a terrible rumour was all over the town that the miscreant was no other than Fyodor Pavlovich. Who set the rumour going? Of that drunken band, five had left the town, and the only one still among us was an elderly and much respected civil councillor, the father of grown-up daughters, who could hardly have spread the tale, even if there had been any foundation for it. But rumour pointed straight at Fyodor Pavlovich and persisted in pointing at him. Of course, this was no great grievance to him. He would not have troubled to contradict a set of tradespeople. In those days he was proud and did not condescend to talk except in his own circle of the officials and nobles whom he entertained so well. At the time, Grigory stood up for his master vigorously. He provoked quarrels and altercations in defence of him, and succeeded in bringing some people around to his side. "It's the wench's own fault," he asserted, and the culprit was Karp, a dangerous convict who had escaped from prison and whose name was well known to us, as he had hidden in our town. The conjecture sounded plausible, for it was remembered that Karp had been in the neighbourhood just at that time in the autumn and had robbed three people, but this affair, and all the talk about it, did not estrange popular sympathy from the poor idiot. She was better looked after than ever. A well-to-do merchant's widow named Kondratiev arranged to take her into her house at the end of April, meaning not to let her go out until after the confinement. They kept a constant watch over her, but in spite of their vigilance, she escaped on the very last day and made her way into Fyodor Pavlovich's garden. How, in her condition, she managed to climb over the high, strong fence remained a mystery. Some maintained that she must have been lifted over by someone, others hinted at something more uncanny. The most likely explanation is that it happened naturally, that Lizaveta, accustomed to clambering over hurdles to sleep in gardens, had somehow managed to climb this fence in spite of her condition, and had leapt down, injuring herself. Grigory rushed to Marfa and sent her to Lizaveta, while he ran to fetch an old midwife who lived close by. They saved the baby, but Lizaveta died at dawn. Grigory took the baby, brought it home, and making his wife sit down, put it on her lap. "A child of God, an orphan, is akin to all," he said, "and to us above others, our little lost one, has sent us this, who has come from the devil's son and a holy innocent. Nurse him and weep no more." So Marfa brought up the child. He was christened Pavel, to which people were not slow in adding Fyodorovich, son of Fyodor. Fyodor Pavlovich did not object to any of this and thought it amusing, though he persisted vigorously in denying his responsibility. The townspeople were pleased at his adopting the foundling. Later on, Fyodor Pavlovich invented a surname for the child, calling him Smerdyakov, after his mother's nickname. So this Smerdyakov became Fyodor Pavlovich's second servant, and was living in the lodge with Grigory and Marfa at the time our story begins. He was employed as a cook. I ought to say something of this Smerdyakov, but I am ashamed of keeping my reader's attention so long occupied with these common menials, and I will go back to my story, hoping to say more of Smerdyakov in the course of it. Alright, there we go, another chapter down. Another good one. I mean, I really liked this chapter, I followed it. I understood it all, that felt good. It's starting to like sink in and everything's going smoothly now, so I'm really starting to enjoy this book, which is a good thing. Have your say about the chapter over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Other than that, thank you very much for listening today, and I'll see you tomorrow.